Hello, and welcome to the Robert A. Heinlein Book Club. In this episode, I will talk about Citizen of the Galaxy, which was originally published in 1957, serialized in Astounding, and then published later that year. You know, I'm actually surprised how many of these were serialized. I assume they were just those Scribner juveniles were just the contract. That he published these before in Astounding. I mean, it'd be interesting to maybe look at those original versions of them to see if they changed, because we've seen evidence of that before, where certainly with Sixth Column and some of the other early novels, they were changed heavily when they were, published in book form or published as part of anthology later on. But that'd be really for hardcore Heinlein fans to maybe dig out. But you know, I had the idea he was kind of done with Astounding by this point in his career, but he apparently wasn't. So anyways, also sorry for being a while. I've had a lot of work issues to deal with the last couple weeks. So, things have slowed down, but I'll still, try to get through this Heinlein series over the next, 6 months or so. That's what I'm aiming for. We're running out of stories. We're pretty much down to novels for the most part. And I'm almost finally done with the juveniles. I'm really excited to get to more of the adult novels. I'm currently reading Door into Summer again, which has been really fun. So anyways, Citizen of the Galaxy. This is the 11th of the juveniles. And as we've seen throughout this series, looking at the juveniles, they kind of become more mature and more cosmic as they go along. And this certainly fits into that pattern, where this is probably, from what I know of the last of the juveniles, this is the broadest. It's got the biggest universe. It's the farthest in the future, and it's the most adult in any ways. In fact, by the end of the novel, he is essentially an adult. The idea of this being a juvenile is actually, it's hardly a juvenile novel, in the sense that, like, if you go back and read this next to Rocket Ship Galileo, it's really night and day how different they are. This is pretty mature. I've heard that Have Spacesuit Will Travel is more YA-ish, maybe the most juvenile of the juveniles in some ways. And maybe that's interesting in its own way, being the end of that series. But given I don't know what's quite in that novel yet, I have to say this seems not only is like the strongest entry in the juveniles, it's the biggest in terms of theme. I think it's also the longest. It felt longer, and the printout I have is longer. It's like 20 chapters. Usually these juveniles were 15, 16, 17 chapters. This one was like 23 chapters, I think. The end is kind of drags a little bit. I guess that's my overall criticism of it, is like, it's really engaging and there's so much wonderful world building here. If anything, this is thematically much like the Green Hills of Earth, but once you extend it out to the cosmic scale, but still explore that theme. So if we look at the Green Hills of Earth stories, that I'm talking about the whole set, that whole anthology and the stories around that, where it's about humanity first taking those tentative steps into the cosmos, and then developing a separate space culture, right? A big part of that, a big theme there is that the spacemen and the earthmen, they're going to be culturally different. They're going to be divergence in their attitudes and their values, because it's necessary to be that way. You can't really have Earth people in space, and space people can't make it on Earth. And that's the tension, right? So we have that story where these people who live on the moon try to go back to Earth and find they can't go home again. Or we have the poet laureate of, the author of the song Green Hills of Earth, right? The blind poet, he can't make it back. He dreams of Earth, but coming back to Earth is kind of beyond him. It's not something he's able to do, and instead he dies in space. this divergence, but the longing for Earth, is at the heart of this. But it's just at that much more cosmic scale. It's zoomed out incredibly. We actually don't get a clear idea of when this is, and it's way, way in the far future. We're talking about, it must be hundreds and hundreds of years. It's like almost on the level of like the Foundation stories, that far in the future, where, you know, we have these thousands of humans living on thousands of planets with humans settling it, and then all these different cultures and different political organizations and different factions and different cultures emerging, and humanity sort of bifurcated into all its different branches as it spread out across the universe. Just like how humans, when they left Africa, you know, broke out into the thousands of different cultures and languages we have today on Earth. The same thing happens, and there's big gaps between them. There's conflicts, there's value differences. There's really no clear centralized political unity. You know, in that sense, it's different than Foundation, I guess. But, you know, I'm just thinking about the scale of humanity's place in space. There is this, like, hegemonic guard, which is sort of the police force, you know, kind of the descendants of the space patrol, I guess, from those. And there is, like, an anti-slavery effort going on from Earth. But Earth, for many of these people, is a fantasy. It's a dream, right? And we've seen this before in science fiction and other stories where, over time, Earth will just become a dream. Even Philip Dick wrote a story like that. What was it? What was that story called? Now I forget. Impossible Planet. That's the one. Impossible Planet, where you have someone wanting to return to Earth, but Earth is a myth. So they just kind of drive her around in space, you know, giving her a ride before she dies, and then they do run into Earth eventually, right? Wonderful setting. I mean, I think this could be the last Juvenile that we really need to read. But we'll see. I've heard good things about Half Space Juvenile Trial. I just think chronologically it fits maybe in another place in the order, because I think these, if you just line them up, like I said before, these first 11, they get more mature thematically, and humanity's place in space is more mature. And this is obviously the most mature of that. Our character is still a young boy, competent, not particularly interesting, maybe a little bit better than some. Thorby is his name. He's not too bad. He has some motivation, but I still find the other people around him more interesting. That's the problem. We don't have, like, lost in space kind of issue. Maybe you could squint your eyes and say some parts of this fit that tried and true device that Heinlein used, but he doesn't rely on that. This novel just stands on its own. I think if it was published as just an adult novel, it would be fine. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be in the series to exist, right? And I think it's one of his better novels that I've read of his. So even though my issues with the end are that it just kind of gets a little, it drags for a little bit for a while after he returns to Earth. Because that's the twist in the novel, is that Thorby's actually from a fairly wealthy family on Earth. When we meet him, he's a slave. We meet him at a slave auction on a planet, Jubble. And he's a nobody. He's a young slave. And the person who buys him is a beggar. His name is Baslim, and he's actually known as the title Baslim the Cripple. And we get our first sense that we're going to be exploring other worlds, other cultures, like how humans thrived. It's like something interesting in Star Trek. Obviously, you have different cultures across different planets. But one thing I think Star Trek didn't explore nearly enough, it tried a little bit. In the original series, you had a bit of this, and you had a little bit of it in Next Generation, is, you know, because the typical Federation planet is like at peace, regulated weather, you know, everyone is, you have post-scarcity, you know, you have the Star Trek future on most Federation worlds. But there are a few failed colonies, right? There's like especially in early Star Trek The Next Generation, you have like those abandoned, like lost colonies, like the Irish colony or the genetic clones. That's the same episode, I think. Or Tasha's planet, right, which is like at Civil War, and we meet them through Tasha, and then we meet them one other time in one episode. I think it's like in the fourth or fifth series season, where they're just at war. It's like a failed planet where there's like rape gangs and stuff, where it's like they're humans. They come out of the Federation, but they failed, and they kind of went their own way, which you'd expect more of in a galactic empire, right? I pick on Star Wars a lot, but I guess I got to give Star Wars some credit for at least doing a little bit better in this regard of not homogenizing the planets. But earlier Star Trek, I think, had this this question. Like, certainly the original series had this. Like, isn't there the planet that Kirk is from, where there's like a dictator and people are being assassinated? I totally kind of forget that story. It's like a genocide story, right? Where the guy like kills, he Thanos is the planet, right? And he's in hiding, the dictator's in hiding, and you know, Kirk runs into him. But I think that's where Kirk is from in the original series. So the idea that some planets are going to like become monarchies and some will become you know, more prosperous, and there'll be trade, and then maybe we're thinking of Dune too, because Dune has this world building quite well. And I'm thinking of that because you have like a Spacer's Guild, essentially. You have a population of merchants who live on ships and are like interplanetary, and they're essential to the functioning of the economy, right? But they have their own culture and their own values. They see people who aren't of their, they see the spacers essentially as a separate race, right? The people, they call them, and everyone else is Frocky, which is basically kind of a term for an animal, but they're not truly human, and they can't be human until they become part of their essentially clan, and they're matriarchal, while the people, like most of the people on the land, are patriarchal still. You could tell, like, Heinlein just, he's got that gender thing in his head constantly. And even in these juveniles, it comes through. This one really strong, where you have, like, experimental, like, marriage. Like, you have marriage contracts here, obviously. He comes back to this all the time. I think he really needs to there to be marriage. He wants there to be marriage contracts with set dates and set times. He's not a big supporter of monogamy, obviously, and so he works it in. And, you know, I think it's reasonable to assume as men and women become more equal, the monogamy will become less important as a social institution. You can say I'm just projecting into the future my own desires, the way Heinlein has been accused of doing. Maybe, I don't know. But we're already seeing, like more women choosing not to marry, right? And women having more sexual partners. I guess Zoomers are having less sex, but I still think my understanding is that those that are a little freer in their sexuality. We're having more people experiment in open marriages and non-monogamy things, ethical non-monogamy. And I think the material conditions that make this possible must be like some degree of equality between men and women. Like, women no longer are dependent on men for their survival, and men aren't dependent on having a woman to run their household, right? It's, you know, and there's no more longer this focus on the family and passing on your genes. People have different values. People value things beyond family in ways that they never have before. One reason why we're having fewer children into the developed world is people are finding more valuable things outside of marriage that they want to pursue, right? And that's a good thing. But that means marriage becomes less crucial as a social institution. And that might have all sorts of lead to questions and concerns. But certainly the idea that we're going to stick with like biblical style, like monogamy, or I guess they have polygamy too in the Bible too, right? That's not the best example. I mean, like, I guess early modern past, you know, up to the present monogamy. The idea that we'd keep that when the material conditions have changed, I think is kind of ridiculous. So we'll see where it goes. Will it be Heinlein's vision? I don't know. I just think he got this one right. And And I think that's why it's important to like kind of see there's this radical edge, at least in his gender politics. And I think even his libertarianism, such as it is got a bit of a radical edge on it. I mean, it's something maybe I need to dissect later on. You know, I'm never going to think about much about Heinlein as I have like Philip Dick or even Lovecraft. And that's just the way it's going to be. But, you know, I think there's a time, I think, to evaluate him not from a... Here's my issue. You have the critics of Heinlein, generally more progressive people who see him as a fascist, who don't like his right-wing stance, and he kind of has this reputation as being a guru of the right wing. And then you got his defenders who are of the right wing, not all, but many of them are more right wing. And they say, yeah, he is the guru of the right wing. So like Heinlein's actual message, I think, is more complex than this. And I'm not trying to apologize for his really bad ideas that come through all the time in this book, but I mean, I just think there has to be a more objective reevaluation of what Heinlein is trying to do. And that's an aside. And I don't know if I'm the one to do it here, but I don't see this kind of fascist right winger in when I read Heinlein. I just don't. So anyways, the story. So I think I got off track when I was thinking about like the world building again, because this novel keeps doing the world building and it's wonderful. So anyways, Thorby, our main character, gets purchased by the beggar, Baslim. And now Baslim buys him as a slave cheap. He's like, no one wants to bid on him. So Baslim buys him up for just a very small amount of money. And even the seller is kind of upset with that, but it's whatever. He has to sell him, right? He gets what he gets for him. And Baslim then kind of adopts him. So this is a bit of a issue. Like, you think this is going to be a novel just about slavery, and it begins and ends about slavery. And it's an anti-slavery novel throughout, but that's always a problem, right? It's the same thing like in Django Unchained, where one of the protagonists, is using slavery as a convenient means, but actually is anti-slavery at heart, right? Baslim is anti-slavery, and he raises Thorby essentially as a family member and teaches him how to be a beggar, which is like an established tradition and job, really. It's like how begging in China is this way, where begging is just the job that people have. But he gets his schooling through Baslim too. He becomes fluent in many languages, which of course is useful for beggars. There's the local language. There's a language called interlingua, which apparently is just like the pidgin language that's shared by people across cultures. Something that the lingua franca for the civilization. And eventually Baslim gets arrested. As Thorby grows up, he learns more about his career and what he's actually doing. And actually Baslim is a beggar, but begging is just like the cover for his real job, which is basically running kind of an underground railroad or something, passing on information about slaves and anti-slavery activism. And he has ties and connections all throughout the goddamn universe. Like, he has favorites he can call in from all over the place, which is really cool. And now he tells Thorby, learn this message, and he memorizes it in a different language. But Thorby's smart enough that he's able just to repeat it. And he says, if I die, if anything happens to me, you go to a ship and you repeat this. And the reason this works is because Baslim has debts, or people owe him debts from all over the place, right? So he's an important figure, even though Thorby thinks he's just like a essentially a homeless guy. But over the course of the novel, learning more and more about his father's, his pop's background, it's really, really cool. I think it's sad that this kind of gets stopped at the end. I think, you know, basically Thorby going back to Earth stops the novel in its tracks. And there's some good stuff after it, but it's like, they're really interesting. We want to know more about Baslim. We want to know more about like this world and this this human position in space, the cosmicness of it. I think it would have been fine for him just to go back to Earth and the novel ends in some ways. I don't know why it had to drag on. And that actually fit thematically the Green Hills of Earth, because in a way, can Thorby ever go back home again? Right? The theme of Green Hills of Earth is you can't really. Once you're in space, you become of the space of, you know, moon people can't go back, even if they want to. It's impossible. You can dream of Earth, but it's not approachable. And Thorby's able to go back. And that's not quite as satisfying, I think, as an alternative narrative would be. But anyways, Bazlum is arrested, probably for his anti-slavery activism or being kind of a sussy person. And he kills himself before he could be shortened. That's the term for killing, for being killed, is shortened in this culture. Thorby then is the target of a manhunt. He hides out in like a halfway house because, again, Bazlum has all sorts of friends that owe Bazlum something, and Thorby's able to cash in those debts. But eventually he goes to a ship, the Sisu, and the Sisu is the captain there is one of these people that owes Bazlum something. So he repeats this message in this other language, which basically says, like, I am Bazlum the cripple, this is my son, you owe me, you have to take care of him. And so they have to smuggle him on board because he's wanted and he can't go through normal customs and everything. And I think the debt he owes is something about, like, anti-slavery activism. Like, really, he's like Bazlum sort of running an underground railroad, it seems. And then they take him on board. And then we join and we meet the traitors, the guild of spacemen. These are the people that don't belong to any world. These are people who are just by nature traders. So they just move around. And they have their own awesome culture. Now, how we're introduced to this, it takes several chapters. And it's some of my favorite parts of the novel. Because everyone is snubbing him. He's been welcomed in because the captain has to pay back this debt. But the crew doesn't like him. They call him Frocky. And don't much care for him. They think he's a bit weird. They think he's an outsider, ultimately, is what it is. Frocky essentially means not part of the people. The free traders call themselves the people, or just people. So they're people, everyone else is kind of not a person. Now, this is a bit troublesome, this idea that you would get like these harsh like racial divisions in humanity, but it's also not hard to believe something like that could happen, you know, if humanity ventured out into space and people were separated for hundreds of years, and the only thing connecting these cultures are the ships of these traders, you're going to get different cultures emerging. And those cultures will have different racial attitudes. And some might be slaveholders. Some might be more like the Federation. It seems Earth is closer to the Federation in some ways, although it's still capitalist, as we'll see at the end. But in terms of values, like anti-slavery, but others on the fringes, you know, are the, you know, slavery is active. And there's actually a conversation about the economics of this and how frontier societies tend to have slavery. Now, Heinlein doesn't quite get to what my thesis about this would be, but I think it gets pretty close, is that in frontier conditions, you have a lot of work that needs to be done and a dearth of labor. So if you don't have a lot of labor, that's going to push up wages. But even worse, no one would need to work for someone else, because if you're in a frontier area, you can just take land, right? There's opportunities for everyone if they just like work a little bit, right? They're not competing for resources. It's kind of a post-scarcity situation. But you need work to be done. So the only way to get work to be done is through force. So like in the Americas, this is why you had slavery in the Americas, but not in Europe at the same time. It wasn't that there was a moral opposition to slavery in Europe. There were black slaves in Europe, but the Americas took off with that because you needed a forced population to get anyone to work, right? Who's going to work on a tobacco plantation if you can just have your own farm down the road, right? So you needed an underclass to make that economy work. And you know, I don't know if other frontier cultures have this issue, but certainly that's what happened in the Americas. because of the deaths of the Native American population. There was no population to, you know, put into the state to control them, right? You had that in Europe. You had a population in a state that could be taxed and exploited with normal means without slavery. In America, you didn't have a population. You had settlers who could take land. The Native Americans were mostly pushed off the land or killed or wiped out by disease. So you needed to bring in the subject population. And the only way to do that is slavery, right? No one's going to say volunteer to leave Africa to go to America. It has to be slavery is the only way to do that. So it's kind of based on the material conditions of the world. And I think Heinlein's sort of getting to that in his section on frontier. He also talks about the lack of law and order, that there's no, and this is something you see in Bernard Bailyn's book, The Peopling of British North America, where he talks about the Americas as a marshland, what a marsh is in politics. It's like it's a borderland that is going to kind of have its own quasi-independence. And it's even a cultural and moral independence, according to Bailyn. So, and partially due to the fact that there's no like controls in the frontier. And he even talks about this in terms of like American religion being a little nuttier than European religion. It's because there wasn't the controls from the center. You didn't have the Pope or the King controlling the religion. So religious nuts just kind of flourished there. Same thing with slavery. Slavery could flourish because there wasn't a control preventing the worst aspects of slavery, or the worst aspects of exploitation of labor. So anyways, we learn a lot of this through Thorby's conversations with another outsider on the ship, an anthropologist who is there to study the free traders, and eventually she wants to also study Thorby's planet, Jubal. And so they become the first friends, and then eventually he is adopted by the captain. Thorby's able to, I think it's actually through Bazlam's demands that he becomes part of the free trader culture, and he gets adopted. Once he's adopted, he's in the clan. He's one of the people, essentially genetically. So there's a lot of cool anthropology here, and you just got to read it to get all of it. Like a huge part of this book is just the world building about cultures and customs and family relations, and you know, and the free traders have very, very complex relations, even though many of them are artificial. Even they have rules on marriage, like you're not supposed to marry someone from the same ship, right? You're supposed to marry another free trader. You have to marry someone of the people, but not of your ship, because that's kind of considered incest. It breaks the incest taboo. And so there's like swapping around of women and population swap across ships, you know, as people marry and move around. I think that's really interesting too. It's like there's some real research in anthropology must have been done to get all this, because it's really, really fascinating. Now, these are matriarchies too. The captain's wife is the most powerful person on the ship, at least in theory. She has the symbolic control. Now, the captain has the day-to-day control, but she actually runs things sort of behind the scenes. Now, eventually, he does his heroic thing. Thorby has his day in the sun where he saves the ship from pirates who are slavers. So we have enslaving pirates or another. They're kind of the flip side of the free traders. They're also of space. They're not tied to any land. They're also traders because they're trading slaves, but they're the pirates who are kind of parasites on this intergalactic economy. He saves the day. This rises him up. It allows him to become, you know, I think, you know, he's able to like be a marriageable companion. So they're trying to marry him with another like ship. There's a lot going on here in the story, but it's all world building. It's just all juicy, wonderful world building. And we start to learn more about Bazlam at this point. We're about halfway through the novel at this point. We start to learn more about Bazlam, and we learn that he was actually a captain of the hegemonic guard. So not only is he like involved in this underground railroad stuff, he's also essentially a like a high-ranking official in the intergalactic military. He'd be like Captain Picard or something, right? Who became a hobo at some point. Maybe the colonel or something. But he was not ever truly a beggar. He was really a double agent, or is it a double agent, or just a secret agent of the anti-slavery hegemonic guards fighting against slavery on this planet. This encourages Thorby then to follow in his father's tradition and join up with the guard itself. He serves in there, and then this allows the mystery of Thorby's background to finally be revealed. So we meet him as a boy, and he thinks of Baslam as his father. That never really changes. And he becomes the adopted son of this captain, and then the captain dies at some point, so he has different relations, and then he's part of the guard. He's had many familial loyalties throughout his life, but the question of who he actually is there. Now, I think this is kind of a stupid, irrelevant question. Who cares what his background is? He's a slave, right? But that's why I kind of want the novel to end at this point. Maybe it's not that, the end of the world, that he learns that he's actually Thor Rubdeck, the heir to like the richest corporation in on Earth. So he's an Earthling, not only an Earthling, not only Terran, he's like the richest Terran. And he's been missing. Like, okay, it's possible someone like this become a slave. Caesar was a slave for a while, right? That happens. Maybe that's fine. I don't know. Why does it have to be this way? Now, even if he is going to be that way, I think it's enough for him to go home and then find he can't be there. It's not good enough for him, right? But instead we get several chapters. And I should point out, the reason he ultimately does feel he can't be part of this is that his company finds out has connections in the slave trade, right? Because it's a big multinational, multi-planetary thing. He's got money everywhere. And there's like whole chapters describing all the different money everywhere, all the different things he owns. Sometimes he has like 1% in a lot of different companies. But it's very complex. There's like, he has to go to school just to kind of learn all this. But he's introduced to his family. He learns about the business, and he's told, like, actually, you're like a billion, you're a trillionaire. You're the richest guy in the world. And here, you were a slave, but now you're super rich and whatever. And he meets all his real family members and people he has no history with. His real family are the free traders, right? Baslam is his family. He just sort of is like a weirdo who shows up here. He's got no training in business. He's told he has to go to like Harvard and get his degree, and he does all that. Anyways, but all of that, it's fine, I guess. I just don't think the story really needs it. But really, this is all just set up the big tension at the end of the novel. And what are we at? We can kind of start to wrap up here where this novel goes. Is the real tension at the end of the novel is Thorby decides he wants to turn away from his company because of the slave trade, right? He tries to go through legal means. He tries to like vote one company to stop investing in the slave trade or something. And that sort of works, but he realizes that's just one of like millions of companies or thousands of companies he has. And this company can never be not associated with slavery. And so he's like, well, maybe I should just like go back and join up with the hegemonic guard and fight slavery that way, right? Do I fight slavery with a pistol in the military, or do I fight it as a capitalist trying to purify his evil corporation of just one of its evil aspects? So, in like a leftist reading of this is like, I don't know. Actually, I don't know how to read it. Because I see it in a couple ways. One is the romantic side is, go in the core, abandon the company. But of course, the company is going to go on, right? So in a way, Thorby does make the right choice. He's like, I'm going to try to fix this company, at least its most evil aspects. But even if you were to expunge Rudbeck and Associates of slavery, which presumably he's going to do, he's going to spend his whole life doing it, company by company, bit by bit, it's still like an evil corporation, right? It's still going to be doing pretty nasty stuff. I just don't have this fantasy of an ethical company, right? But slavery is the fight he's going to have. So he's going to try to reform it. So he's like Nog at the end of Deep Space Nine, who has to reform the Ferengi. His heart's in the right place, but how is he going to do this? And then the novel just sort of ends with him realizing this. So I don't know. I think the ending's interesting. I think it's thematically got something. Returning to the issue of slavery is important because the way slavery is dealt with in the beginning of the book is kind of like, oh, it's not that bad because I'm just going to adopt you as a son. I don't really believe in slavery. It turns out I'm an anti-slavery fighter. So you were never really my slave. You were just my adopted son. Okay. You know, that's fine. I'm sure that happened in time. But, you know, I was thinking at the time, like, at that point in the novel, it's like portraying slavery this way, it's not great. You know, Thorby does talk about his time as a slave before being sold to Baslam, where he has still scar marks on his back. He's like, I don't know how I got them, but I have them. So returning to slavery, I guess, is important. But the way it's done, like, that he basically inherits a corporation that's all tentacled in with the slave trade. And he's like, I got to devote my life to stopping that. Not freeing the slaves, not ending slavery, because that's an impossible task, but at least wiping my hands clean of this evil, right? And not any of the other evils this company might be involved in, right? I think that's a little too clean. So, but I guess that's it. That's the story of Citizens of the Galaxy. Even with my little bit of discomfort with how it ends, I just think there are other ways it could have gone. I think him just doing something in the Hegemonic Guard to struggle against slavery would be as satisfying as what we got without all this chapter after chapter about how Thorby has to like learn business school and stockholders meetings. We're going to get enough stockholders meetings in Doran to Summer, and they're much more interesting in that case than what we get here. I don't know. Maybe there's a different way of doing it, but what we have is fine. But none of that distracts from just how awesome this book is in terms of its world building. I think it is a perfect capstone of the Juveniles. And I want to just pretend this next one we're going to read in a couple weeks an exception or a coda or out of place, right? Like if I could renumber these, this got to be number 12, right? I don't know. Maybe if we add Podkayne and Starship Troopers, make a 14-volume series, we want to kind of renumber them, starting at with Rocket Ship Galileo, obviously the smallest of them, thematically. And this is actually the biggest. You know, this is the biggest world we've had seen from Heinlein, I think. I don't think we've seen anything bigger. In anything, and it's great. And he nails it. It's not like it's hard for him to describe a world this big. Maybe it took him step by step just making the world bigger and bigger in each novel. But at this point, he has no problem like putting us into this world with all these different cultures and values and economic systems and growing divisions between people and just the diversity of cultures. It's great, right? In this globalizing world we're in, where cultures are being homogenized more and more by capital, the hope that the frontier can rebifurcate humanity, I think is pretty appealing, and it's somewhat appealing to me. Certainly it used to be. And I think it's something that's on Philip Dick's mind through all this. Remember, Philip Dick is starting to write novels that are thematically quite similar at this point with some of his, he's actually into novels by 1957, I think, like Solar Lottery. And the other one, the one about Venus, the world that Jones made, which is really all about humanity stepping into the stars or not. Like, that debate is at the heart of it. So, like a timeline, lining up Philip Dick and Heinlein, I think would be fun. Because their careers, Heinlein starts much earlier, but by this point, their careers are lining up. And they both die around the same time. Maybe something to work on. Anyways, I think that's it. 40 minutes. I guess cramming it into one episode just made for one longer episode, which is good. 40 minutes is plenty of time to talk about it. There's obviously more that could be said. This is a rich, rich novel. Definitely encourage you to read this one if you haven't. I think it's the strongest of the juveniles. I put this above Star Beast just a little bit at this point. Star Beast has its own things I like about it, but this one I think it's the strongest. And we'll see if Half Spacesuit Will Travel changes my mind on that, but I'd be surprised. Now, next is Door into Summer. We'll be looking at that in the next episode. I'll just do one episode on that one as well. Then after that, we actually have two short stories, finally. It's been a while since we looked at one. Tenderfoot in Space, I just couldn't find, so I'm not going to do it. Couldn't find an audiobook for either for that. So there, I might do a cleanup at the end. There'd be three works on the cleanup, a Tenderfoot in Space. And then what? Bulletin Board and Poor Daddy. That's the only cleanup, as far as I know, that I'm going to have to do. But I'll wait to the end of the series to do that if I am motivated. So put that as a debt I might have to repay to you later. For now, The Man Who Traveled in Elephants and The Menace from Earth. Menace from Earth is a future history. We haven't talked much about the future history stuff, and that's probably a good thing. But The Menace from Earth is a late future history short story. And then The Man Who Traveled in Elephants is just a, I don't know, it was anthologized in The Pleasant Profession of Jonathan Hoag. So it might be more fantasy, if I'm guessing. Not sure. I haven't read them yet. But that's what's coming up. So that's it for now. So anyways, what do you think of Citizens of the Galaxy? I'd love to hear what you think of this story. And I'll see you next time when I'll talk about Door into Summer, a novel I have read before, and I'm actually liking it a lot more in the second read through. So I'm looking forward to talking about it with you. So that's it for now. See you next time. Thanks for listening.